It's quite amazing for me to be sitting with all of you in the Zendo tonight. I'm going to invite, because there are so many of us, the people who are behind the fireplace, if you want to move forward so you can hear better, just you can move into the aisle in front of you. For the rest of us, we'll sit in our Zazen practice while we listen to this talk, which is how we listen to talks here at Boundless Way Temple. From within our practice, from within our upright stillness in the middle of everything. Having so many of us here tonight, and I understand from the registrar that we'll have about 10 more tomorrow night, it makes me, of course, recall the early days of this coming and going session, when, as I recall the story, and of course everything turns into stories in the past, David was sick up in his room, I was at work, and Steve gave a talk to Fran. Things have changed, but maybe not so much. There's a way that I hope that you can hear my talk tonight, as if you were the only person here in the Zendo, and I was talking directly to you. Tonight we read a piece by Musō Soseki, who was an interesting character, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. But first I'll just read this lovely piece that's part of our new liturgy book, Realizing the Zen Way. Zen points directly to our original nature. If one realizes original nature, one knows that fundamentally birth and death are without form. This is true longevity. One sees nothing to call misfortune. This is true security. One leaves behind the notions of has and has not. This is true gain. One sees there is no one to despise as an enemy. This is true conquest, true love and respect. Once one realizes these principles, one realizes the Zen way. So this piece is a little bit challenging for me because it points so much to the absolute nature, that side of our practice where there are no problems. And earlier today, we approached the Zen way from the other side. What do we do with the passions that arise endlessly in our hearts, the othering that is so much a part of being human? Musō Soseki is pointing us in another direction. But before I tell you a little bit about that piece, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Musō himself. He had two names, actually. Musō Soseki was the name he gave himself after a series of dreams that made him go pursue the Zen path. And his name, Soseki, supposedly literally means dream window, because in his dream he saw the way. Later, the emperor of Japan, and Musō Soseki lived in the 13th and 14th centuries in Japan, in Kamakura, where there was a lot of exciting Zen practice going on in the Rinzai school. The emperor of Japan at the time renamed him, and so sometimes you find him referred to as Musō Kokushi, which means national teacher Musō. So this Musō was, when he was 3 years old, orphaned. We don't know who his father was, but his mother was a court lady, and she died when he was three. And in the custom of the times, he was given over to Buddhists to take care of him. And he became, throughout his childhood and adolescence, a great scholar of Buddhism. He eventually joined the Shingon school, which is an esoteric, kind of mystical, magical version of Mahayana practice. And he outdid everyone. He was one of those outstanding students, great scholar of the way. And one day he was at a funeral. Was at the bedside of one of these great Shingon scholars who was dying in agony. and he was concerned about this because at that time he had great faith in Shingon as a way to transcend the pain of death, and here was this guy not doing that. So he turned away from Shingon and went to study with a Chinese teacher who had just come over from China named Ishan, and he took vows as a Zen priest at that time, and I think he was about maybe 20 years old, something like that. And he studied with Ishan for quite a while with this idea that he would gain enlightenment. And I think we've been talking about that all through the Sesshin, how misdirected that gaining idea can be. How we think who we are is not it. We think dying in agony is some kind of mistake. We think being angry or afraid or sad is some kind of mistake. But certainly the way that we teach in Boundless Way Zen and the way that I teach is that all of these things, as Dave said earlier, are already Buddha. There's no awakened nature that we can cut away from ourselves. Everything is it. So if everything is it, then a peaceful death or an agonized death, a happy day or a sad day, all of it, as Steve said the morning after he became a sensei last week, is a fine day. Fine not in the sense of, yippee, this is so cool, but fine in the sense of, this is it. And of course that is what I understand awakening to be. Soseki says in another text that is in a book called Dialogues in a Dream, which is a series of letters that he and one of the emperors of Japan exchanged. He says that awakening should be understood as a drunken person sobering up. I love that. Just, you know, we often say waking up, but sobering up. Like, wait a minute. Everything I thought in my delusion of what it meant to be a human being has worn away as the poison has left my system, and I see now that everything I thought was not the awakened nature is actually the awakened nature. Not because we've heard these kinds of teachings, but because we know it for ourselves. As Hakuin Zenji, who lived a couple of hundred years after Musō Soseki, said, it's like knowing for yourself whether water is warm or cool. So one day, after many, many, many urgent periods of zazen, really intense, trying to get enlightenment kind of periods of zazen, stretching over years, because remember, Musō Soseki had been a great scholar and really applied himself. He did the same thing with his Zen practice, just kind of a practice, because that's what he thought was required. He came to his teacher, Ishan, and I want to tell you what happened between the two of them. So his doubt and anxiety at his own lack of realization and clarity grew until one day, in desperation, he said to Ishan, I cannot attain enlightenment. Show it to me. Ishan said, there is no word in our school, there is no rule to transmit. Musō wouldn't take that, and he said next, show me your compassion and your way. And Ishan said, there is no compassion, and there is not any way. This is quite a thing to say. There's no compassion. There's no way. So Musō gave up. He said, I've had it with these crazy Zen people. Remember, he had given up on the Shingon school too. That was, I guess, part of his personality. He said, I can't go forward with this. This is just impossible. And he went to find a teacher who spoke his own language, a Japanese teacher, who was also a Rinzai teacher in Kamakura. And this guy, Koho Kenichi, received him. And Ishan told Koho the whole story. I'm sorry, Musō told Kosho the whole story about what had happened with him and his teacher, Ishan. And Koho said, you should have said to Ishan, teacher, you have revealed too much. And at those words, Musso had a little bit of a glimmer of something, enough to bring him back to Zen and to continue his practice for many years. And then one day, when he was about 30, he was sitting in a hermitage, and he went out and sat in the garden. And there was a cool breeze. It was a summer night. And it got very late, so he rose to go back into the hermitage. He didn't have a light with him, but he knew this hermitage very well. He'd been sitting there for a long time, so he didn't need a light. And he got a little bit unsteady on his feet at one point and reached out to support himself with a wall that he knew was there, but there was no wall there, and he fell down. And in that moment, he burst out laughing. And all the intensity that he'd been carrying around with him all these years, suddenly for himself, he knew something. He had sobered up. And this is when he went rushing back to Ishan, his original Zen teacher, and Ishan gave him transmission. So he also later went to Koho, and the same thing happened, and he received the transmission in these two Rinzai lines. And then this is one of the really cool things about him, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't quite believe it. I guess around the 13th, 14th century, people made lots of stuff up. But maybe this is true. It's said that he had 13,145 students recorded, their names recorded, and probably many more, lay people, monks, nuns. And he had more than 50, I think the number was 57 Dharma heirs. And some of his students included 7 different emperors of Japan and the shogun. So he was a pretty famous guy of his time. And through his Zen teaching, which was not Zen teaching alone, he was also a poet, and he built many temples and monasteries, and he invented the Japanese garden, the garden that has stones and water features and all of the models that we use when we create the beautiful garden here. You might say that David Roshi and Dharma teacher Fran Ludwig are following directly in the path of Musso, Soseki, when they created this garden and continue to create it over and over again, making adjustments, adding features, adding beauty, great beauty. And he made gardens, Musso, all over Japan using these principles of Zen to create places where people could have the kinds of experiences that he felt were important to have as Zen practitioners. A way to encounter beauty visually, and through his poetry to encounter it through words. Quite a person. And so this little piece that we read tonight, that I just read to you, Realizing the Zen Way, is from his book, Dialogues in a Dream, the series of letters between him and one of the emperors. And he's basically saying something that I think we all want. We all want to live a long life. I think most of us want that, maybe not all of us, but we want to live a long life. We want to be secure and not have terrible things happen to us. We want to get stuff that's good. We want to have beautiful gardens and nice clothing and great places to live. We want things, material things. And we want to be in charge, some of us. You know, we want to have conquest over others. And he says that the way to these things, longevity, security, gain, and conquest, are not what we think they are. Instead, if we want longevity, he recommends that we see our original nature, this awakened nature, this sobered up nature. In this clear seeing, he says, the seeing that we are already Buddhas, then we know that birth and death are without form. There's nothing we can point to as birth. There's nothing we can point to as death. Everything constantly rising and passing away. We are born and die in every moment. being born and dying are happening constantly. And then, of course, there is the actual consensual reality birth and the consensual reality death. He actually talks about this idea that there is a kind of reality that is shared by human beings that is a part of the great reality, which includes it and also is much bigger than it. So there is actually birth and death, and also birth and death are arising so much over and over again that we have to see through them as nothing fixed. And in this way, we attain a long life, he says, because our long life could occur between this in-breath and this out-breath. Eons pass in a millisecond. This is true longevity, he says. And then true security, he says, this is understanding that there's nothing that can actually be called a misfortune. And this is pointing to teaching that arises everywhere from our ancestors and even into the present moment. We're talking a little bit about it today, that everything that occurs can be seen as good or bad, but really we don't know whether it's good or bad. As an old Taoist sage said about misfortunes, how do you know that they're not blessings? What's your evidence? Well, it's pretty bad. Well, yeah, but maybe this led you to something that you never saw before. Maybe something has been revealed in what we call a misfortune. When we get very sick, maybe something shifts in our consciousness once we surrender to the sickness and we discover something new. Something that if we cling to the idea that sickness is a bad thing, we don't get to see. Someone says terrible things to us and we feel awful and hurt. And it's important to let ourselves feel what we feel. When we're sick, we feel sick. When we're attacked, we feel attacked. But then ultimately, is this really a bad thing? If we use it to wake ourselves up, nothing can be put in the category of bad. Even our anger and rage at our leaders, when we see that this is simply the arising of passion, then we can learn something about what passion feels like, smells like, tastes like. And in this way, we sober up more and more and more. And true gain, true attainment, true getting, this is seeing through has and has not. Does a dog have the Buddha nature? Right away, Zhaozhou, our teacher from many, many centuries before Musou lived, said, don't get caught in has or has not. Wu Men, who lived a few centuries before Musou and collected that story in his collection, The Gateless Barrier, says, with a bit of has or has not, body is lost, life is lost. And so when we see through has and has not, then we gain everything. The jewels that are hidden in our pockets are revealed to us. Everything is already here. Everything we've ever wanted, already present. And then true conquest, an interesting translation. I don't know what the original was, but I imagine it had something to do with defeating an enemy in some way. When we see that there's nothing to despise as an enemy, that there's no one out to get us, no one who is trying to trip us up, nothing getting in our way, then we win. We win everything. And Musou says that this true conquest is actually true love and respect. I certainly know this deeply for myself, that once I get through any hurt or anger, fear, sadness that an encounter with another person brings me or an encounter with my critical self brings me, and I let myself be saturated by all the feelings that rise and fall away, at a certain point, everything drops away in a kind of exhaustion. I grow so tired of myself, of all of the battling. I put down my sword and shield, and the only thing that's left is true love, true respect. So I want to end the talk with a little poem. I said Mousseau was a great poet, and he wrote a lot of poems. I found this book years and years ago. It's called Sun at Midnight, and it's a translation of Mousseau Soseki's poetry by a great Zen poet named W.S. Merwin, who worked with a Japanese teacher and translator named Soiku Shigematsu. And when I got this book at a used bookstore, I was so excited about it because it was in pristine condition. And I thought, that's lucky, and it's only a dollar. I wonder what's going on. Well, my luck. And then I discovered that at page 56, it starts again at page 10 and goes up to 56, and then it goes on to 57 eventually. Somewhere in the universe, there is a copy of this book that's missing about 40 pages. But this one has 40 extra pages. And so this poem comes twice in this particular edition. And when I was reading through it the first time, I thought, wow, this sounds like another poem he wrote. It's exactly the same poem. And in honor of our coming and going, Sesshin, here in the deep winter in Worcester, Massachusetts, in January of 2018, this poem is called Snow. Flowers of ice hide the heavens. No more blue sky. A silver dust buries all the fields and sinks the green mountains. Once the sun comes out on the one mountaintop, even the cold that pierces to the bone is a joy. And I'll read it one more time in honor of this particular $1 edition. Snow. Flowers of ice hide the heavens. No more blue sky. A silver dust buries all the fields and sinks the green mountains. Once the sun comes out on the one mountaintop, even the cold that pierces to the bone is a joy. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. And again, I invite people behind the fireplace if you'd like to come forward a little bit, but of course you don't have to, so you can join in our Dharma dialogue. When we invite people to, all of you to come forward with your questions, your comments, insights, arguments, anything at all.
Thank you for the poem. It was beautiful. Especially love the first line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what'd you love about it?
It was so original to hear snowflakes described as flowers. Mm-hmm. Flowers of ice. Just beautiful image. Mm-hmm. And that they're blotting out the blue heaven, or however that was put.
Oh, thank you.
I just loved hearing some of the stories of these ancient times and these amazing people, and I think maybe my very favorite scene in your talk was relating the story of him losing his balance a little bit and reaching out for the wall and it wasn't there and falling over and then just busting out laughing. I thought, wow, that sure sounds awfully familiar. So often I've found that's just this little bit of, well, look at this right here. And what can you do but laugh? It is hilarious. Lovely thing.
Yeah, I love that part of the story, too. When I came across it, I actually laughed. How many times have we done that, right? You know, that we think, I got it.
it's all set. And it's like, whoa, it's not all set. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also knowing a little bit more about him. And
yeah.
All of, you know, he was such a dynamic person. He really worked hard. Mm-hmm. And maybe when we work hard, any of you who know what this feels like, because I think a lot of us are like this, there's a certain point when we think, I got it. Mm-hmm. Oop, nope.
I think for most of us too, we don't always laugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. It can appear in different ways.
Yeah.
Right? The sky turns blue in a different way from the words coming out of our mouth. But yeah, sometimes when we're let down, when what we thought we could count on isn't there, sometimes we can break through. And the great mistake becomes the great joy. And in that moment, the laughter, unavoidable.
Thank you, Melissa, for putting the spotlight on this chant, this new chant. And I particularly appreciated the pointing to how easy it is to be mistaken, you know, about this, these things that we get these ideas about how things are and or how they should be, right, in our minds, so in my mind, how things should be, and how he points out, I was kind of feeling like he was moving me back and forth, mm-hmm. as we were reading it, and, you know, showing us that, well, you might have thought it was this, but actually, it's this, and you might have thought it was that, but actually, no, it's, you know, and pointing to something that seems really so different than the idea or the concept that we have in our, that I have in my mind of what I thought, and where it takes me is to remind me, you know, not to believe everything that shows up in my mind. It's so easy to be mistaken about everything, right? And it also, to me, it points over and over again to, you know, my definition is just way too small, looking through a little straw and missing the big picture.
I went outside today for a couple minutes and enjoyed the path that Lara cut. Went once in both each direction around, and I saw the snow, and it's what I think of as dirty snow, and it's all melting and crusty, but especially over in this side, it's got all the little bits of all the different trees on it in this amazing arrangement. I don't know, it's different, so different from the snow in Nepal, but
yeah, this amazing arrangement.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful phrase. Yeah, my understanding of Musso's gardening technique is to let a lot of natural arrangement happen. Mm-hmm. That's what I think is so. So there it is.
Fran and I actually went out earlier to arrange the branches. Really appreciate the mission.
Well done.
Guys are just a mess.
No point.
Very beautiful. Just like Musa.
Well, let's come back into silence and continue on with the point.